This week on Art of the Air features interdisciplinary artist Melly Hoppe using dance to inspire young students. Next, we have author David Hoppe, whose most recent book, Mid-Century Boy, is a memoir about growing up in Chicago suburbs. Our spotlight is on Lebesnik Center for the Arts exhibit, We Are Us, that explores the human condition through the works of 24 artists.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM and WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at LakeshorePublicRadio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available on our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our shows are available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for more information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight from the Lebesnik Center for Arts in Michigan City, going to talk about the upcoming exhibit that's really interesting. Laura Fosberg, welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Hi, Laura. Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, we love having you. And you're just closing out your next exhibit, but you have a new one coming in November. And it involves, I think, about 24 artists, and it's very detailed. So tell us about that.
Oh, it's an incredible show. It all started with a loan of 10 Alex Katz paintings from a private collector in Chicago. And Alex Katz, in case you don't know, is like one of America's finest artists. He's in all the major museum collections around the world. And at the moment, he's having a retrospective at the Guggenheim Museum. So we sort of timed this show to go with that. It's a big deal for us to have Alex Katz in Michigan City. And we're super excited about that.
Well, I have to say, your whole list to me is like a roster. It's like being in art history class anyway.
I'm so glad you noticed. We are really pulling from art history for this one. You know, there's so many important artists, including Romare Bearden and
Etta Kollwitz.
Yeah. Alice Neal, one of my all-time favorites. Ed Ruscha. It goes on and on. Ivan Albright, Toulouse Lautrec, Jacob Lawrence. And then we have some really important contemporary artists. Mandy Cano Villalobos and Sidney Lewis will be showing with us. And their work is incredible. So the idea behind the show is the human condition. It just felt like, you know, we've been through some really, really hard times lately. And the art world is put here to reflect on the times. And I'm always trying to curate shows that are about the moment. And I just feel like we've been through such a hard time with COVID, with, you know, such a diverse situation we're in America. And I just thought it'd be great to talk about feelings and reflect on us as human beings, and that we're all part of the human condition, and that we all are one and one for all. And that's kind of what the show is all about. It's about artists and their incredible ability to depict and document the human condition in all its varied forms, in the good, the bad, and the ugly. So we've got some of the world's best artists to help represent that.
Yes. The title of the show is We Are Us, The Human Condition. And it's a wide variety of things, how the art of communication exists beyond just language and time. And it's like you described, Laura, it has a whole wide range of things that it's exhibiting there. And that really is a get for Lobeznik to get some of those artists into your space. I mean, you have been, like Esther just said, you're bringing some really major things to Lobeznik.
I'm doing my very best, and I have to thank a lot of partners for it. Like I said, a private collector from Chicago, actually several, because we're going to show some glass artists as well, because it is the year of the glass,
uh-huh.
or the year of glass, which has been dedicated by, I don't know if it's the UN or it's an international celebration of the arts this year. And so we're participating in that. So we'll have some glass art as well. And we'll have installation art and then lots of prints and paintings by these incredible painters. Some alive, some not alive, some part of the historical record and some hopefully entering into the historical record. So it's a really exciting show for us. The opening reception is on November 4th from 5 to 8 p.m. It's free. We'll have cocktails and snacks for you. It'll be really fun and a great opportunity to meet and greet other people who are like-minded or just to get out of the house and have a little fun for free. And then I'll be doing a gallery talk on November 12th at 11:30 a.m., and that also is free. It lasts about an hour, and I'll just kind of walk through the show and talk about different artists and the ideas behind the work, and it's really fun. Again, a great way to meet people. And then one more thing, we have a family day on February 11th, and that's from 1 to 3. Again, free, always free at the Lobeznik. Bring your family, bring your auntie, bring your grandma, bring the kids. We have all kinds of activities that are organized. We'll have snacks, etc. Really fun for the community.
Laura, is there will there be an online viewing of the exhibit so somebody can?
We haven't quite gotten that sophisticated. We always put up a couple of images, but if you tune into our social media, we are constantly posting images of the show throughout the run of the show. This one runs until February 24th, so you'll have plenty of time to see it. We're open 6 days a week, closed on Tuesdays, free every single day. And if you would please just go to our website so you can tune in and check it out. It's lobeznikcenter.org.
Very good. We have about a minute left. We want to talk about what's coming up, but also if anyone wants a special gallery talk, they can maybe arrange that with you, maybe a group, school group or something like that. They can always do that, correct?
Well, the great thing is whether if you have a school group, we go through the education department and you get a docent through there. If it's a tour for adults, again, it's free. You can call anytime and the tour is given by me. So, like I said, call anytime and we'll be so happy to accommodate you.
We always like your enthusiasm about what is happening at Lobeznik. And so we'll just wrap it up here saying that it's the We Are Us exhibit, The Human Condition, and it opens Friday, November 4th, 5 to 8 p.m. That's, of course, that's first Friday in Michigan City. Curator Talk is on Saturday, November 12th, and Family Day is Saturday, February 11th. Laura, thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thanks, guys. Bunches. It's always great to hear from you both, and thanks so much for your attention to the arts.
Thank you. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. This is Pledge Week for your public radio station, and Art on the Air encourages our loyal listeners to support this station by making a monthly sustaining pledge so we may continue to bring you this great program. You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
It is a pleasure to welcome Melly Hoppe to Art on the Air. Melly is a nationally credentialed teaching artist with young audiences, Arts for Learning. She has a BA in dance from Columbia College in Chicago and an MFA in interdisciplinary arts from Goddard College in Vermont, and received a teaching artist certificate from Teachers College at Columbia University. She was the artistic director of Sasuras, an Indianapolis-based non-for-profit performance group from 1993 to 2013. All those credentials cannot begin to speak of the creativity, innovation, and joy she brings, whether in a classroom or other collaborations. Thank you, Melly, for joining Larry and I on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome.
Aloha.
So good to see you.
So, Melly, we like to always start out our show to find out a little bit about our guests, their origin story. How I like to say it is how we got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us about yourself.
Well, I grew up in Michigan City. I'm the youngest of eight children, and we had a pretty artistic household. My dad played the piano. My older sister danced. I have, you know, brothers who played in bands and an older sister who played piano. And I started, you know, dancing a little bit when I was younger, and I was pretty shy. So I wasn't really comfortable with it until I got in high school. And I think I got enough confidence to actually take dance classes. And I was also interested in health fields. So I went into dance therapy. That's what I became interested in. And that's what I studied in college, dance therapy.
And tell us about any high school experiences that you had along the way. That did anything you do there kind of enhance what you became eventually to do?
Yeah, actually, I was in the high school musicals, and I was the student choreographer. So even though I got my degree in dance therapy almost immediately out of college, I started choreographing, and I was mostly been a choreographer throughout my life. And a dance teacher, but I haven't really practiced dance therapy. But my high school experience at Elston, choreographing the musicals, that was my first experience actually choreographing, and I really liked it.
And so tell us about some of the shows you choreographed.
Oh, boy. I choreographed. I'm trying to remember. I think it was Camelot.
Oh, yeah.
And Fiddler on the Roof. I know we did Pippin. Those are the ones that stand out.
Those are two of my favorites, Fiddler and Pippin. The one thing about Fiddler, which I hope your director did, is when you get to the wedding scene, you have to cut some of that music because it goes on for like almost 400 plus measures. So you have to make some productive cuts there. But yeah, and then Pippin, I dearly love that show. You can't do all the Bob Fosse style choreography at that level, but it really is. Yeah. But it's really good. And just so you know, I'm a retired theater director, and I work with a lot of student choreographers. So they bring a lot of creativity to the game. So
in high school, Melly, did you... was there an opportunity to choreograph more modern or contemporary pieces for yourself? I mean, was there that opportunity rather than these shows?
Not yet. Not till college did I do that. I didn't really, I mean, I knew about modern dance, but it was pretty much doing the musicals. And in fact, as I think about it, I mean, that's why I really wanted to study dance after, you know, when I started getting in musicals, I wanted to choreograph, and I had to study dance to be able to choreograph. So it was kind of going at it in a backwards way. Usually people study dance and become choreographers. And I wanted to be a choreographer and study dance to do that. But
so do you remember as a child, did you, when you hear music, were you already like putting the movements to it like most children do? I mean, do you remember, do you have like those memories?
We would do shows as a family because we're a large family. But my older sister was the choreographer then because I was little, and I did what she asked me to do. And I, you know, I don't remember when I first like would hear music and think about movement to go with it. I can't remember exactly when that happened, but I'm sure.
Or even like for me, it's even just the leaves blowing or something. It just all inspires such movement. I don't know.
Yeah. I agree. I can't think of an exact like time where that happened, but I definitely, you know, thought about movement in that way, you know, from a young age.
So tell us about some of your post-college choreography and dance work, as well as the other things that you were involved with.
Well, right out of college, I was still living in Michigan City, so I did some work with South Hole Dance Company in South Bend. I choreographed for them and taught some modern classes. And then in 1988, my husband and I moved to Indianapolis, and I started teaching a lot of around the area in dance studios, and eventually started my own company. We did mostly site-specific theater, site-specific movement theater. So it was physical theater, very community-based, and very site-specific in terms of we'd be all over the city. Almost, there are many places in Indianapolis that I set pieces in.
So did you find the sites, or did people come to you saying, we would like for you to produce in this particular place? How does that transpire?
Usually I found the sites. There would be a really interesting site, and I would want to set a piece in it. And I think one of the first ones that I did was called Sacred Spaces. And we went to Crown Hill Cemetery. There's an arts garden. That was when that was kind of new in downtown Indianapolis. It had kind of beautiful lighting. The chapel at Christian Theological Seminary. So we traveled around and did dances in these spaces. And that was part of the Spirit in Place Festival that is still happening in Indianapolis.
What about Light Screen? That one, that installation looked just, I wish I could have been there for it. What was that?
Which one?
Light Screen. Wasn't that where the panels were?
I did one called the Dunes Project, where we had panels of the dunes, of pictures of the dunes. And then I did a collaboration with, I taught site-specific theater at Butler University, and those students collaborated with the Ball State architecture students, and that piece, maybe that was called Light Screen. It was so long ago. I'm sorry. I don't remember the name. But that was really interesting because that was in the old Irving Theater in Irvington, Indianapolis. And we based that performance on the book, The Devil in the White City. Oh. So the students researched the characters in that book, because that's in that story, he ends up going to Irvington. That's the last place he goes. And so we basically created the piece based on that.
This one that I was referring to is, it was like in a walnut grove, I guess. And I think your collaborating person was Kurt West. Did that, I don't know, maybe that one didn't happen and it was just written about. I remember seeing the images of it, and but it could be one of those things that was just not produced, actually. It looked fabulous, though.
That's great.
But with your teaching, the young children, movement and song is like such an excellent way for some students to really lock in the learning in their bodies. And when you sent a video link to look at, or we saw a video link of you teaching a class, and it was just so beautiful. Do you find, and so we're seeing the level of like an extreme level of engagement with the students, with the movement. Do you find that just historically true that?
Yes. Yeah, I do. I feel like dance is a way to reach students, often students that have difficult learning in other ways, because dance is kinesthetic. It just automatically will engage some students who are having a hard time engaging otherwise. It's a collaborative process, so they get to work together, they get to play, all these things that, you know, make it fun, but also can be challenging too, and stimulating intellectually.
And like with some of it, there's no right or wrong. So the movements that they do are right for them, which probably gives them that extra level of confidence to reach further. I mean, that little video clip was just magnificent.
So in your busy life, Millie, you somehow went and studied and got an MFA. Tell us about that.
That was a low residency program at Goddard College in Vermont. So I was able to still live in Indianapolis and work on that project. And I was choreographing and doing a lot of site-specific theater. And the interesting thing about that process is I was doing, at that time, so many works for others. And Esther, you asked about that, whether other people were asking me to create things on site. Well, it was often like I was getting commissioned to do work, which was great at that point. I reached that level, but then I realized it wasn't, there wasn't me in it. It wasn't, it was all about something that was very external. So I went very deep and I actually created a video with my dad, and it was right, basically the end of his life. He had Parkinson's disease. Mm-hmm. And I went really inward to create that video about kind of, it was like finding out like what was home for me, what was my roots. And that's what that, my MFA project was that video.
Wow.
Wow, that's something. So you also did arts administration for a while, and that was for a young audience in Indiana. So tell us about that experience.
I was the director of artist services, so I was the person who auditions people to become part of the roster for, at that time it was called Young Audiences, and I would also evaluate programs and work with artists on professional development before they would go into the schools or while they were in the schools. And now that's what I'm doing. I'm not an administrator, but I'm an artist with Arts for Learning. I'm a teaching artist with Arts for Learning. So I did that for a few years and wanted to be, I would go watch programs and I would want to be there doing it, not watching and evaluating. And so just, it was a good experience because I learned so much and appreciate the administrators that I work with. I can see it from both sides now because I had that, I wore both hats. So I'm glad I had that experience, but I was really ready to get back in the classroom and teach and work with kids myself.
What brought you back to Northwest Indiana?
My husband and I moved to his family home. His parents died about 10 years ago, both in the same year. And they have a house not too far from Lake Michigan. And we, our choice was to stay in Indianapolis or to come back to Lake Michigan. And we both love this area. And we knew we were eventually going to do it, but we didn't know it was going to be so soon. But we did it. And my mom's still here. I have family here. So it's good to be back home.
And what are you kind of pursuing right now? What type of things are you doing right now that you're back in the area?
Well, it's interesting. I go back to Indianapolis a lot. I actually teach there. I'm going a lot in October, November, doing residencies in schools there. So that's great. It keeps, I still have that connection with Indianapolis and the schools there. But I have been doing work at Pine Elementary, working. Last year, I worked with every class doing dance workshops. And what's so great about Pine is that they integrate the art teacher, music teacher, and I work with the classroom teachers to do a fully integrated project on some curriculum area. So, for example, I think with first grade, it's going to be Phases of the Moon. and so the art teacher will do something, the music teacher will do something, and I will do something with dance based on that. And then they do a showcase. So they do a little performance at the end of that unit. And
it sounds so satisfying, like a nice circle.
yeah. I think it's really great. It's a really good example. I talk a lot about arts integration. I work with people all over the country talking about arts integration, but Pine Elementary what they do is such a great example of a fully integrated program where the teachers and art teachers are working together on projects. So that's fun. And it's fun because so often I go into a school once or maybe it's a week and I never go back. And it's been great to be there. I think it may be close to 7 years that I've been going to Pine now every year. So I know the teachers, I know the school. I have, you know, history with the kids. There's a, it's really great. It's really satisfying.
You get to watch them grow up. That's wonderful.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, oh my gosh, you're so big. So that's great. When you're a freelance teaching artist, you don't often have those kinds of experiences.
Do you ever have that urge to choreograph another musical?
I kind of moved away from musicals when I started doing more of my site. I taught in the theater department at Butler for 10 years. I taught site-specific theater and stage movement. And I did do some musical choreography for, they had a musical theater program for a while, and I was the choreographer for those. And I've kind of moved away from that. And I'm very happy with the kids working with the, and I like kind of the structured, you know, what I do is really more, I'm a movement facilitator where the movement comes from them and I'm not setting movement on them. Sometimes I do. I mean, sometimes we have to kind of pull everything together, but for the most part, I like to just encourage their own creativity and then structure that. Rather than doing, you know, what we're with musicals, it's often like you're actually choreographing something and setting it on the performers.
And it's telling the story. You're using what the script and the director wants to move the story forward. I mean, that was the great integration that happened with Rodgers and Hammerstein. They integrated all three elements of acting. The story had to emanate, the songs had to emanate from the script, and the choreography had to support the story. It wasn't just like, let's stop the show and do a number and then move on. They integrated all those into like the narrative form of musical. I had is about, in your information, you said traditionally choreography is democratic. Would you explain that to our audience about what you mean by that?
I think that... you know, it's a process where, in my process, the movers have say as much as the choreographer does. So it's a collaborative process. So
I see.
Think more what I mean by that.
Okay, so in other words, not the choreographer dictating all the movements, it's much more the dancers bringing their movement to you also.
Right. And then I will have final say though, in terms of what, if, you know, ends up going on stage. But yeah, it comes as much from the performers as it does from me in terms of the actual movement.
So, Melly, I don't want this kind of to be a favorite child query, but sort of just when you think about your work, is which piece of work or collaboration still makes you kind of tingle? And when you think about it, does it lead you to want to re-explore that work and maybe expand on it? Or are you mostly interested in creating new work?
That is a hard one because there's so many pieces that when you say that, I can think of so many pieces that I just had really fond memories of. And so much of it is the actual process of creating the piece and the community that's created in that process. Mm. And there's no way to recreate that because there'd be different people and it'll be a different process.
That's true.
It's a different community. So it's very ephemeral. You know, not only is the performance itself, but the actual creating of the piece. And so when you think about that, I immediately think about the people. Oh, yeah, it was so great to work. And I am going back to Butler for their 75th anniversary, and I'm teaching a stage movement class. I haven't taught there for 10 years, and many of the alums are coming back to take a stage movement class with me. And when you say that, you know, when you said favorite piece, I'm thinking actually the stage movement classes I had at Butler with those students, many of which I'll be seeing in October. And, you know, those were really special times, you know. But again, I don't know what it'll be like because they're, you know, it's 10 years later, 15 for many of them. And it won't be the same. It's always different.
Yeah, it'll be sweet.
Every moment is different. You know, every experience is different.
Are you looking forward to anything that you haven't done so far that you want to do?
Boy, good question. I don't know specifically what I'm looking forward to in terms of what I haven't done before. I think, I actually think I would like to go back and do more reflection on what I've done before. Not necessarily something new, like a new idea of something I have that I want to create, but I'd like to kind of go back. This reunion thing is making me think about more I'm in a reflective kind of time. And I haven't done a lot of that. So kind of looking at my work, my past work, and somehow even organizing it in some way, some kind of documentation.
And maybe creating a master class or something around that, what you've done, and to pass that information on.
Yeah, that would be great.
Well, we're just about ready to wrap up here. So tell us any projects you have going on that you haven't already discussed, and also how our audience can find you, like on social media, website, things, everything they want to know about Melly, but we're afraid to ask.
I do have a website. I'm not very good at updating it. It's mellyhoppy.com, but you can see the past work I've done on that. And, you know, artsforlearning.org is the organization that I do teaching in the schools with. And my next project is working with preschoolers and preschool teachers, doing a long-term residency where the teacher by the end actually is comfortable enough leading their own dance with their students. And that's what I've been working on. And I'm going to be doing that a lot in October.
Very good. Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. That's Melly Hoppy, choreographer, artist, and just all around interesting background there. Thank you for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your story with us.
Yeah, so lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. This is Pledge Week for your public radio station, and Art on the Air encourages our loyal listeners to support this station by making a monthly sustaining pledge so we may continue to bring you this great program. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art in the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
We have the pleasure of welcoming David Hoppy to Art on the Air. David is an award-winning journalist, author, and playwright. His writing explores the intersection of politics and culture. He has been a writer, editor, and columnist for Nouveau since 1998 and has received 9 first place awards from the Indiana Society of Professional Journalists in a variety of categories. In David's most recent book, Letters from Michiana, he shares his reflections along Lake Michigan's southern shore as 98 dispatches from the front lines of concerned citizenship and keen ecological observation. He has 3-generation history with Michiana that we are looking forward to exploring. Thank you, David, for joining Larry and I on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome.
Aloha. Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
We're real happy to have you on board. And, you know, we always like to start off our interviews with a little bit of background on our guests and your whole origin story. Like I like to say.
The whole thing, David.
How you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us about yourself.
I actually wrote a book about it. It's called Mid-Century Boy. I was born in Evanston, Illinois in 1950. Grew up in the northwest suburbs of Chicago, specifically Mount Prospect, Illinois, and which is where I lived until I graduated from Prospect High School in 1969. Went to college. I attended McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the University of Minnesota. And, you know, I think I grew up in the 50s and 60s. And so, you know, had the great benefit of living through a time that was possibly about as free as any time in the history of the United States.
Very good. Well, tell us about some of your early experiences growing up in grade school, exploring. Did you like to read? Did you like to even write? And all the way grade school, high school, and all that era.
I was always a reader, and I enjoyed writing as well. I was crazy about the movies and baseball and football. I had the great good fortune to grow up around the corner from one of the Halas family, a guy named George Halas, who was just a year younger than me. And he'd throw the passes and I'd catch them.
Wow. So you had a little bit of football there. And just out of curiosity, tell us about teams that you liked.
Oh, my gosh. Lifelong Cubs fan.
Cubs.
Multi-generational Cubs fan, in fact. And, you know, because my best friend was a Halas, I, of course, was, you know, insanely jealous. And I became a Baltimore Colts fan, not knowing that someday I'd be watching them in Indianapolis.
Oh, no. Wow. So
did you like in high school?
Yeah, I love Johnny. I love Johnny Unitas and Raymond Berry.
Ah, so in high school, were you on any journalistic, like the newspaper or the yearbook?
Yeah. I wrote for the high school newspaper for a couple of years. In fact, I got into trouble. I wrote an editorial for our school paper my senior year. About an incident that took place when a vice principal denied access to the school to a member of the SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society. And I wrote an editorial called Fear in Suburbia, kind of melodramatic, but nevertheless true as it turned out. And that made me declared persona non grata at my high school after I graduated. I was told I could never come back. But that got rescinded eventually, and I was able to come back, in fact, and direct a play at my alma mater a couple of years later.
Were you involved in theater? And you say you directed that play, but were you, as a playwright, what background did you have in theater?
Yeah, you know, like a lot of kids, you know, when it turned out that I couldn't cut it in high school sports, I was drawn to the theater. And being a crazy, you know, movie crazy kid, you know, I was very interested in trying out. And as fate would have it, we had a really great drama department at Prospect High School in those days. And the first play I was in, I played Archbishop Cranmer in A Man for All Seasons, take the state championship in Illinois that year as best play of the year.
You know, Illinois is very big on state thespian competition plays and everything. So, yeah.
Yeah, we had a wonderful teacher, Mrs. Lukowitz, Patricia Lukowitz, no longer with us, I'm afraid, but she was tremendous, and she instilled a great sense of professionalism. You know, I was in that production, Bruce Boxleitner, who you may know from many films and television shows, he played Sir Thomas More in that production.
Very good. And did that influence your playwriting at all? I mean, you know, the experience on stage. I mean, tell us about any other state acting experiences you might have had. Any musicals or?
I was never in musicals. We actually did a lot of the theater of the absurd, and I think that was a great influence on me. We did a couple of Ionesco plays, and of course, I had never seen anything quite like an Ionesco play before, but. You know, it was a very tumultuous time. As a group, our theater group went downtown to Chicago to see Murat Saad, a production of Murat Saad, Peter Brook's play, production of that play. And, you know, so I grew up thinking of theater as a really adventurous medium.
That's great. You know, it's great to have teachers like that. My story real quick is we had a couple of our teachers that took us to see The Second City, and I became a Second City. Yeah, it was during the daytime, and I didn't know this till years later, but we saw John Belushi, Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd. They were there at that time. Didn't connect it when I was in school, but then years later, I talked to one of the teachers and said, oh my gosh. And that was such an experience for me. I went to Second City all the time. So it's great, those early experiences.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I think, you know, it was great being exposed to that kind of theater, because I think one of the things I learned early on was that, you know, we have a very literary, in this country and in the West, we have a very literary interpretation of what theater can be. But I've always been interested in theater that, you know, this may sound strange coming from a writer, but I'm interested in theater that rely on language.
Right. Actually, one of the most powerful performances I saw in Chicago was Alan Ruck in a solo production of Billy Bishop Goes to War. This is probably like my single most moving theatrical, you know, solo performance. It was just
interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Just so amazing. So what happened after Mount Prospect? Which way did you head?
Well, I lived up in Minnesota. I went to school in Minnesota and lived there through most of the 70s. After that, moved out to Northern California for a couple of years. I lived in Marin County and worked in San Francisco. And then was offered a job in Michigan City, Indiana in 1980 with the public library. And so I moved back to the Midwest and became the AV librarian here in Michigan City, which was a town that I had a lot of familiarity with because my grandparents had owned a cottage in Long Beach starting in the early 1950s. And so I spent many summers here with my grandparents over the years and was familiar with Michigan City and Long Beach. I had a couple of friends here already from growing up days. And I realized that at that time in 1980, I could actually live on the beach in Michigan City, something that I was unable to do in Northern California.
So you started one of my favorite I mean, I have to say, like, I just adore the Michigan City Public Library. It has been libraries should be the central focus, I think, of most communities. And that one sure has
been
important in my life. And so, but you sort of founded the Writing Out Loud program, which I just totally adore. That still so at what point did you develop the Writing Out Loud program while you were in Michigan City
Public
Library?
That was in 1984, I believe. Yeah, thank you. I mean, it was a thrill to be able to do that.
Brilliant.
At that time, I was going after my Master of Fine Arts degree from Bennington College in Vermont, and I had met a fellow there named Nicholas Del Banco, a novelist who was head of the writing program at Bennington. And he was bringing in writers there, of course, all the time. The proximity to New York meant that, you know, he had the pick of everybody in the literary scene at that time. And, you know, he was a tremendous literary impresario, and I was very inspired by that. So after spending a summer out there in Vermont, I came back to Michigan City and applied for a grant from the Indiana Humanities Council in Indianapolis that enabled us to bring our first round of writers to the public library. In that case, there were a couple of writers who were fairly near at hand. One was Harry Mark Petrakis. He was the first writer to appear as part of Writing Out Loud. And then another was Scott Russell Sanders that year, who was down in Bloomington, but has now become nationally known as one of the great writers, great American writers about the natural world.
Yeah, it's a brilliant, brilliant program that just gets better every year.
So taking you from the library, you were writing all this time, but how did you start mastering some of the other things and starting to actually publish some of the works with all the things you've done, the commentaries about there and also being in Michigan City, living on the lake? And I know in a lot of stuff I've reviewed about you, stories about living on the lake and how that is.
Well, little by little. You know, it's taken a long time. I'm late bloomer when it comes to writing and publishing, I think. It took me a long time to try and finally find my voice. I began writing poetry exclusively when I was in high school. Moved from poetry gradually into prose in the mid-70s. And from there was writing fiction and then finally started writing nonfiction in the early 80s. And it was at that point really that I became friends with Kurt Vonnegut. And Kurt was reading my nonfiction and really encouraged me in that direction. And it was at that point really that I came back to journalism for the first time.
So were you in Indianapolis then when you met Kurt Vonnegut?
At that point, I was in Indianapolis, yeah. I was responsible for producing a citywide book festival in Indy called Wordstruck. And for the first one in 1991, we decided to bring Kurt Vonnegut back to Indianapolis. Indianapolis was his hometown, of course. And but he had not been there in quite some time, and in fact, he had a rather prickly relationship with his hometown. So we invited him to be our keynoter. He came, and I had the good luck to be able to pick him up at the airport, and we spent the next 3 days together driving around Indianapolis, revisiting old haunts, going to various public events. And talking for long periods of time. And, you know, a friendship began. I wrote him after that and asked if we could correspond. And he said, sure. And at that point, he became, you know, someone who read everything that I wrote after that and was extremely helpful to me.
That's so lovely.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
And did he give you feedback, and did that influence the things you wrote?
He did not give me a lot of feedback, you know, except don't move to New York. you know, it was more about, his feedback was more about life. And, you know, you know, he called me up one day and said, do you have any fans? He said, because I'm one of your fans. Aww. He said, do you have any fans? People should be reading this stuff.
And so at that point, how many books had you had written at that point when he asked if you had any fans?
At that point, none.
None? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I was writing a weekly column for Nouveau at that point in Indianapolis, which was the alternative weekly there, and I had a regular column, I would send him each column as it was done, and you know, he'd read it and write me back of all things, you know, and just basically sending me thumbs up.
Good encouragement.
Yeah, I saw one of the things you wrote about is the attack on the lakeshore during 2020 and how the lack of response from the Indiana state government was, at least at that point, in responding to it. And that was very interesting. And it was actually an interesting read because it was poking fun at downstate. Of course, we all suffer that from Northwest Indiana. You know, we're like the other world to Indianapolis, so.
Sure we do. I mean, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write a sustained book about Michiana. We've lived here now full-time for almost 10 years. And, you know, shortly after, you know, coming back here, it seemed to me that this is a place with such a rich amount of history and subject matter, and hardly anybody writes about it. And I thought this for a writer was wide open territory. And I also think, you know, vulnerable territory because, places that don't get written about wind up being exploited in one way or another. And I wanted to write about Michiana so that people could begin to realize how important it is to save and share their stories about this place. Places that have stories, where people tell stories about them, those places tend to get preserved, or at any rate, if they're not preserved, they don't go down without a fight. And, you know, when we moved here, people were trying to privatize the beaches, and they're still trying to privatize the beach 10 years later. There are still cases going forward in various courts. And so, you know, it became very important, I think, to begin to give voice to the work that was being done here by people who were actually trying to preserve what makes this place unique. A large part of which happens to be its natural landscape and territory.
It is. You know, one of the stories or articles you read is like a New Year's Eve. I found that very interesting, a letter from Michiana New Year's Eve. And I love your writing evokes images in your mind, which is what I think a good writer does. It's not just words. It's just like all of a sudden you can see you going, putting on your coats and describing that whole sequence going on.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, and that's an interesting piece because that was written on New Year's Eve between the years 2019 and 2020. And we did not know at that time what was ahead of us in just really a matter of a few weeks, which was COVID-19.
Sure.
I know. It just was like that, too. Exactly. I mean, one day. You know, just in one day, really, or a series of days, everything just changed so dramatically.
Yeah. And, you know, in the new book, I mean, I was writing basically weekly pieces, each one no more than about 500 words. And I thought at first, you know, after about the first year of writing these pieces through 2019, I thought, you know, that this was going to be a book about going places and doing things in Michiana. Then 2020 came along and the pandemic, and suddenly the pandemic becomes almost a framing device in the book. It becomes a kind of through line. And it also made the writing a lot more introspective.
Excellent.
In what way? So you started out one way and then it shaped in a different way. And so you were much more introspective, or the stories that you chose...
I was more introspective because I was in quarantine, mm-hmm. basically, especially for the first year. And so, you know, a lot of what I was writing about was limited to what I could see through my window, right. or what I could experience when my wife and I go for walks in our neighborhood or down on the beach. And, you know, that definitely had a bearing on what I was writing about and how I was writing.
And so how are you staying in touch with the politics of the area then during the lockdown? Because a lot of the stories are, you know, based on the environment.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, life did go on and politics did go on. And so I simply followed them as best I could. But in a way, it was a really healthy thing because, you know, in my writing, I never claim to be an expert. I never claim to be an authority on anything that I'm writing about. I'm writing from the standpoint of somebody who is simply curious and hopefully observant.
Right. It's very observational.
Trying to find out a little bit more about whatever it is that, you know, strikes me as being apt subject matter. So, you know, I was experiencing what was going on along with everybody else pretty much in the same time frame.
Is there any projects you are looking forward to doing that you haven't done, or anything that's like on the back burner that you already pulled the front burner?
Well, there are a couple of things. I'm finishing up a novel right now. It will be my first novel, and it's a dark satire called Mondo POTUS. And it's about a president who puts his presidential library on an aircraft carrier. I'm also interested. I've done a play called Dillinger, which is kind of a ghost story in which John Blinder turns up in a 21st century kitchen in the company of a young woman who wants desperately to be famous. Well, Dillinger knows something about being famous. He was one of this country's first multimedia celebrities. And that play unfolds, and I'd love to find a way to produce that at some point up here, because Dillinger has great history up here.
Who you tap to be the director for that, too?
Well, actually, I do have a director in mind. His name is John Green, and he's at Columbia College, and he directed my play after Paul McCartney.
Excellent. Well, you know, we have to wrap it up here, David. Give us real quick websites and how people can find you and get in touch with you.
Well, people who are interested in purchasing Letters from Michiana, my new book, can simply Google Amazon. Go to Amazon and Google in Letters from Michiana, or just Google Letters from Michiana, and you will find links to be able to purchase the book. Other than that, I have a website. It's davidhoppywriter.com. You can check that out. There's a wide selection of my writings from Nouveau and other pieces of fiction and nonfiction available on that website.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. It's been very, very interesting taking this journey with you. David Hoppe, author, and you can find his work on Amazon, and his website is davidhoppywriter.com. Thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air.
Thanks for having me.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. We would like to thank our current supporters and underwriters, which include regional art patron Mary Levan and Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art on the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good, and you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.